Welcome to the TARDIS Library. A place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
Hey there everyone, and welcome to the TARDIS Library episode number 8. Gosh, 8 episodes since we broke this off from the main Doctor Who show. And here we are. Wow. That's even surprised me, and I produce it. What have we got on today's show? Well, we've got some comic action, as you'd expect. We've got 10th and 11th Doctor reviews from Lex and from Jeremy. But we also have an audio review, and this time around we have a new person joining us. So gather around, make him feel welcome. New boy today. It's... Well, it's not actually a new person. It's Jim Cameron, one half of the Letter Lords, which also runs on the Doctor Who Show Network, I guess you could call us. And he's also one half of the Crinoid podcast, which doesn't run on the Doctor Who Show Network, but we won't hold that against it. Just kidding. Welcome, Jim. Jim will be looking at Day of the Daleks, an audio read by Richard Franklin, which is something I'm interested in hearing about myself. I don't know about you out there. So look, without any further ado, with three other contributors, I won't do a review this episode. We'll keep this episode nice and quick and tight, just like I know you love the review episodes. And let me hit play on the tape, and we'll hear from Jim first, followed by Lex, followed by Jeremy, and I'll join you at the end of the show.
Hello, it's Jim here from the Crinoid podcast and our very own Letter Lords, and I'm just breaking format for a bit to talk about the audiobook of Day of the Daleks. It's an adaptation of Terence Dix's Target novelisation of that 1972 TV serial, which was originally written by Louis Marx. It was released last year by BBC Audio. It's a 4-CD set, which lasts 4 hours and 5 minutes in total. It's adorned with the splendid Chris Akilios cover from the original 1974 Target novel, which was the third one Target released, according to the sleeve notes by David J. Howe. Let's have a look at the production of it first. It's read by Richard Franklin, who of course is Captain Mike Yates from the TV version. And as an actor, you would expect him to do pretty well with this kind of stuff, and he does. He reads well and in an engaging manner, and importantly, acts the dialogue very well. And on that subject, part of the fun with Doctor Who audiobooks is hearing the reader take on the voices that we know so well. And with one main reader throughout this, it's good to get some variation for all the reported speech in this, and you certainly get that from Richard Franklin. John Pertwee's Third Doctor lisps, of course, and it's always interesting to see how the different narrators cope with that. In the case of Richard Franklin, he does well, I think, but occasionally the Doctor sounds like he's just had a stroke, but he has the right blend of the whimsical and the pompous that you expect from that incarnation. The Brigadier is certainly very military. He sounds about 20 years older than the TV version. It's more like a crusty major than the version that we're used to, but it still works very well. Joe Grant is portrayed as well as an octogenarian man could be expected to do, I think, but sounds close to a nervous breakdown at times. Sergeant Benton is, I think, probably the funniest one here. Of course, John Levine, who played the part, has quite a sort of mild accent, but Franklin gives him a sort of wild marmoset in the audiobook, which makes up for the lack of the traditional Pertwee-era yokel in this story as televised. Yates himself, of course, Franklin does a very good job at and does manage to sound younger. An interesting choice from Franklin, I assume it was his choice, for the Earth Controller. He's gone for a sort of German accent, as opposed to the rather silky and mannered delivery that we got from Aubrey Woods in the TV version. So, yeah, he sounds like a sort of Nazi commandant, which is slightly distracting. A very weird accent for the work camp manager. Franklin adopts a kind of half Birmingham, half sort of Fagin accent for this character, but he certainly stands out. So, a more serious or po-faced listener might object to some of the voices that Franklin uses here, but I think they add to the enjoyment. I mean, it's a pretty grim story in places, and I don't think it suffers from a bit of lightness being added here and there. There is another voice here. It is Nick Briggs from Big Finish and TV Dalek voice fame. He does the Dalek voices here, much better than the TV originals by Oliver Gilbert and Peter Messaline. And of course, we're accustomed to hearing his voice as the Daleks, and he doesn't disappoint here. They're as petulant as and intolerant as usual. I would say they're probably slightly too high in the mix. They are a lot louder than everything else here, but it certainly gives them some impact. The sound design is very good. Simon Power from Meon Productions is handling it here. Some quite dramatic music punctuates the action here and there. Not particularly Doctor Who-ish music, but it is effective. I expect there's copyright issues there, but it works fine. There's some occasional sound effects. You get boots clomping, the sounds of different forms of weather. You get some owls hooting and the laser gun blasts and machine guns and all that kind of stuff during the battle sequences, which all adds to the atmosphere. And they even go as far as adding echoes to the voices when Franklin's doing reported speech in tunnels and stuff like that. So it's all good stuff. It all helps add to the atmosphere, and much more effort you get in most of the audiobooks that I listen to. I'm a member of Audible, so I listen to quite a lot of audiobooks, and most of them don't do anything other than a reading and a little bit of music here and there. So I think we're being slightly spoiled here by BBC Audio, which is all to the good. So that's the production. It's worth talking about the differences between the original book and the TV version as broadcast. Terence Dix writes an excellent prologue chapter to this, which doesn't feature at all on the TV version, which throws us straight into the war-torn future Earth ruled by the Daleks and the human guerrilla rebels. And this chapter really sets things up and gives us a bit of background to what their struggle is and how important it is that their mission should succeed, the mission as they see it. And we get extra bits of these human gorillas dotted throughout the book. Speaking of gorillas of a different spelling, we've got the Ogrons, of course, in this story, half man, half gorilla type, sort of guard dogs of the Daleks. They're much scarier in the book version, very savage, much more ape-like in stature, not like the sort of lumbering buffoons that we get in the TV version. So much scarier here. They don't get that well treated by the other characters here. You'll remember from the TV version that Doctor rather surprisingly offs a couple of Ogrons with a gun. That remains in the book. And not only that, we have a sequence where the Brigadier runs one of the Ogrons over, which adds insult to injury, surely. The advantage of a book, of course, is you can get the inner thoughts of the characters that can't be so easily displayed on TV. And the Earth Controller, we get quite an inner monologue from him, which makes his sacrifice at the end of the story make more sense than it does on the TV version. It also works particularly well when we get inside the head of one of the rebels, Anat, to get her perspectives on the past Earth that she visits via the time travel, and her own Dalek-ruled and ruined Earth of the future. There's a few other changes. The tricycle race is much more exciting in the book than the low-speed chase that we get on TV. That's handled very well, both in terms of the actual written word and the sound design. Orderly House becomes Austerly House in the book. I'm never quite sure why, other than a disorderly house is a brothel. So perhaps Terence Dix was trying to distance the reader's thought away from that sort of area. We get a black Dalek introduced here. It's ranked below the gold Dalek, but above the sort of rank and file gunmetal Trooper Daleks, and that one seems to be in charge of the Earth. And another nice addition we get is an epilogue to the book, which was actually planned for the TV version but never actually recorded. At the beginning of the book, we see the Doctor and Joe see some kind of time ghosts, where they see their future selves staring back at them, something I think that the Doctor does with the TARDIS. In the epilogue, we get to see these time ghosts again, but from their perspective. So we get them seeing the Doctor and Joe from the original sequence earlier on in the book, which is not necessary, but it's a nice little addition. So all in all, the Target novelisation tells what was a great story on TV extremely well, and the audiobook takes that one step further and is a very worthy new format for that novelisation. And I would say highly recommended. If you like the Pertwee era and you like the Daleks, then Day of the Daleks is a good one to try if you haven't done already, and certainly the novelisation and the audiobook are excellent ways of experiencing that story as well. That's all from me for now. I'll speak to you again soon.
Hi, it's Lex, here to review issue 3.2 of the 11th Doctor Doctor Who comic. The title is The Scream. Writer of this issue is Rob Williams, like last time. The artist is Leandro Casco, and he's my favorite. I haven't seen him in a while. But this time he's teamed up with Wellington Diaz. The colorist is Triona Farrell, again, like last time. And the letterer is Richard Starkings and Comicraft's Jimmy Betancourt. So that's our crew. To start off, I have to say that the colorist, Triona Farrell, she gets points knocked off this time for giving Alice bright fluorescent green eyes in one of the drawings. Just one occasion, but she's definitely, clearly a brown-eyed individual. And there's nothing big and green reflecting off her eyes that could excuse the mistake. They're just arbitrarily drawn green for a moment. Strange. And another mistake. The bad guy has the word scream written across his forehead. And in this issue, they forget to draw it on his forehead twice. It's just entirely absent from the guy's face in two slides. Also, the facial expressions are a bit weird in this issue. Like when the doctor and Alice, they touch this machine and their memories get sucked out of them. When they're touching this machine, the artists, Leandro or Wellington or both of them, they've continually drawn them both cross-eyed. And it's like 10 pages of them being just cross-eyed and it looks so awkward. No one wants that. No one wants 10 pages of just cross-eyed main characters. It's very awkward. Alright, so now that I've started this issue off negatively, I'll just go ahead and give some more negative criticism. The comic begins, more or less, with sort of a whole herd of the Silence. Yeah, the Silence are back in this issue, which is great. I'm excited about that. Now, the artistry in the first couple of pages is lovely, but the wording attached to them is this excruciatingly obvious type of explaining the plot. And it's spoken by the bad guy of this issue, who happens to be a supervillain member of the Silence. He's named The Scream. I've already mentioned that guy. But yeah, it's that, like, that lazy artificial way of getting a listener into the story of just telling them exactly the motives behind what the bad guy is doing. It's really boring and totally unnecessary. We don't need to know the background of the Silence. I mean, you wouldn't be reading a Doctor Who comic if you didn't know who the Silence are. And if they don't know who the Silence is, too bad. They don't deserve the explanation. You know, don't explain, make them watch the show. Despite this issue opening up in a really boring and blatant and obvious manner, the actual storyline behind the bad guy is tragically hilarious. It turns out that there's this one member of the Silence that's so potently forgettable that not even his own people can remember him. I know, poor thing. So he's gone rogue because of all that angst and loneliness, and he's found a special forest to suck memories and destroy the world. So everyone will remember him. Basically, he's the exact opposite of the Silence. Everybody forgets them. They're silent. Everybody remembers him. He's a scream. I do kind of like the anti-parallels there. So he's doing his thing with a species he's found. It's called the Planting, with a capital P, the Planting. Basically, the Planting is going to replace all indigenous life. It just takes over wherever it's planted itself, I guess. So that's enough about the bad guy. The Doctor and Alice, they finally come into the story exactly where the story left off in the last issue, with the Doctor and Alice losing their life energy through some electrical energy-sucking machine thing. It sucks out their memories, and for some reason this process of losing their memories causes them to turn wrinkled, veiny, and old, which I think is ridiculous. What does memories have to do with your physiological body? But that's what happens. So this one rogue Silence member, ironically titled The Scream, has targeted the Doctor because he's so old. I guess he's a jackpot of memories. And yeah, that's pretty much it. It's a strange and really contrived plot. in my opinion. And it made me question the method of how they even came up with it in the first place. It's so contrived. I have this idea that this issue just came from the single notion of having the Doctor go up against some bad guy, as usual, of course. I can just picture the writer Rob Williams going up to his boss saying, "Hey, I have this idea. It's going to be this villain who wants to plant himself in the memories of all people." And Williams' boss is like, "Yeah, great idea. Yeah, how?" And then Rob Williams panics and goes exactly with what he just said, but taken literally. And so comes about this issue where a forest takes over the world through memory plantation. Get it? I don't know. Is that genius or just plain laziness? I don't know which. Probably a little bit of both. Oh, and David Bowie's back. He's returned and he takes over the rest of the issue. He just takes over. He saves the day. And there are tons of David Bowie lyrics and the Man Who Fell to Earth references. If you like those, that'll make you happy. End of story, the Earth is saved, the bad guy's plans are awesomely thwarted, of course, and this sapling progenitor child of the planting that does the memory-sucking forest thing. It might be that this child is the new companion to travel with Alice and the Doctor. We'll see. Could be awesome. I'm really looking forward to that. So, to summarize this issue, there were some clever moments. There were more absurd moments, definitely a lot more absurd moments than clever moments. The issue overall is very good. Yes, there were quite a few mistakes that I've told you about, and it's sort of a sloppy storyline, but it's definitely enjoyable. That's issue 3.2. Catch you all later. Be well, and thanks for listening.
Greetings, greetings, fellow comic readers. This is Jeremy Bement from the Doctor Who Panel to Panel podcast. And I realize that I have been lax in reviewing the 10th Doctor comics, but we're going to fix that starting with this year 3. If you haven't had a chance to read the past couple issues of the end of year 2, we're going to skip over those. I'll give you a quick synopsis of what happened there by reading the previously from the cover of the new Year 3, issue number 1, or number 3.1, however you want to look at it. And we will jump into this brand new story, which I think it's always good to start out fresh, and since it's a new year, new start. Previously, after saving the entire universe and prevailing against the Asiren god Sutekh's impossible power, the Doctor, Gabby, Cindy, and even an amnesiac Nubis are ready to set off on brand new adventures through time and space. But something is amiss, and the world is no longer as we knew it. So, the Doctor is able to stop the evil Sutekh and send him packing, and in the process gain a new companion in Sutekh's son, Anubis. But as this story starts out, we discover that the Doctor has no idea where he's at, or who he is, or what's going on. All we find out is that whatever is going on, things are kind of strange. There's a giant sky-high department store. Gabby is working at a restaurant and having a really, really bad day of it. And they've lost their dog, which apparently is Anubis. But as we go through and continue on in the story, we discover that there's some really big, ferocious, evil alien things that are eating people. And it's one of the reasons why you have to avoid being on the streets or being around the department store. And Gabby is realizing that things aren't right. And I think they're sensing something's wrong. And Cindy is even realizing something's wrong. She has a good friend, but she's running around looking for her dog. And no matter what happens, I think she even, when she does find her dog, which is Anubis, Anubis knows that there's something wrong, and he's trying to reach into Cindy's mind and help her realize what's going on. And I don't want to give away too much because this issue's brand new, and I must say that it's a nice surprise at the end of the story. It's a shock to see that I believe something will be coming back. And this this ending gives you a really wondering, a big question about where the story is going. I guess I'll just kind of leave it there. This story is written by Nick Abadzis. It's called Breakfast at Tierney's. This is part one. This is written by Nick Abadzis, who is the ongoing 10th Doctor writer. And we have a new artist, Valeria Favokia and Georgia Sposito. Well, Georgia has been drawing the 10th Doctor comic here for a while. Richard Starkings and Comic Craft's Jimmy Betancourt doing the lettering. And Hi-Fi and Ariana Florian have done the colors on this. Andrew James, who has been the longtime Doctor Who Comics editor, has stepped up and is now senior editor at Titan. So Jessica Burton is now the editor of the 10th Doctor Comics. So we have a new editor. So I wonder if we'll notice a difference is how the story goes, if it's different than the previous couple years. But as far as my review of this, it was nice to have a nice fresh start. I think I've mentioned in previous episodes that I felt kind of lost the way Nick Abadzis was telling the story, and now that the ending of year two has come out, I look forward to reading it like straight through and kind of making sense of the entire thing. This first issue for year three was very straightforward, I think. It starts everybody off on this brand new playing field. Not only the readers are starting off fresh, but the Doctor and his companions are starting off fresh, just because they have no idea what's going on and they don't remember exactly who they are and what they're doing in this world or where they're at. It raises some questions, it gives you some action, some excitement, and at the very end it gives you a couple other questions that leaves you wanting to know what's going to happen in the next issue. So I feel that Nick Abadzis has done a good job of setting up what's going to happen in this story, and it was well written, and he got his point across very clearly to me. As far as the artwork goes, Georgia Sposito's art, you can definitely tell her artwork. I still like her artwork because it feels almost like you're reading an animated version of the 10th Doctor. That's what to me that's what it feels like. And the new artwork by Valeria Favokia. I'm sorry, Valeria, if I'm not pronouncing your name right. Your artwork, you can tell where Valeria's artwork is and where George's artwork is. The two styles mesh together very well. They flow smoothly from one to the other and back. But Valeria's artwork has, to me, a little bit more of a manga feel to it, which is totally fine. She still captures the look of each of the characters, from the Doctor to the companions. And the artwork is very nice and clean and crisp. And from the opening page, when you see the inset picture of David Tennant, and to me it looks dead on all the way through the book. Everything is nicely done. Nice work on the backgrounds. The coloring, I thought, was very, very good. And I've said a couple times, I look forward to seeing where this story goes. So I give this two thumbs up, or in a grade scale, I give it a B or a B plus. So make sure that you grab this off from your local comic book store and read it. So, this is Jeremy Bument, host of the Doctor Who Comics Panel to Panel podcast. You can find me on Facebook, look for Jeremy Bument or Doctor Who Panel to Panel. Find me on Twitter at Doctor Who P2P. And you can also email me and let me know what you think about my reviews, as well as my episodes, at Doctor Who Panel to Panel at gmail.com. And I wanted to make a special note that if you've been following along on the 10th Doctor Comics all this time, my next episode, which will be episode number 72, will feature a one-on-one extended in-depth interview with writer Nick Abadzis. He sat down and chatted with me for almost an hour and a half about his career, his interest in Doctor Who, all sorts of different things. So if you want to learn more about the writer behind this 10th Doctor comic, make sure you subscribe to Doctor Who Panel to Panel, and depending on when you listen to this episode, either eagerly await the next episode or download the episode 72. So until next time, bye.
Well, there you go. Episode 8 of the TARDIS Library, done and dusted, in the bag, and any other cliches you can think of. My thanks to Jeremy, Lex, and New Boy Jim for their contributions. Hope you enjoyed their reviews of the comics and audios. And of course, we'll be back next time in the TARDIS Library Episode 9, probably sometime in early to mid-March. We'll see what other reviews the team's cooked up. And of course, in the meantime, you can get in touch with us, hello@thedwshow.net. Let us know what you think of the reviews. Let us know what you think of other Doctor Who related items are out there that fit in with the TARDIS Library theme, whether they're books or audios or comics, reference books. There's a whole world of stuff out there. I know around Christmas time, there was a new hardcover reference book that came out with all this gorgeous artwork in it. I've got to pick that up. So many things to buy. Look, I'm going to go off now and weep because there are so many things to buy. So until next time, I've been Rob Irwin. You've been listening to the TARDIS Library. Take care of yourselves. Bye for now.